Dr. Russell Kirk.
To be kind of that.
Advantages, whether or not those advantages have certain Education Association and the great labor unions and a good many others. But these people have, in fact, no common platform for centralization. There is no centralizing party as such. There is no centralizing interest as such. So when each of these groups sees an opportunity for private advantage or the advantage of their particular group, they push forward towards centralization regardless of the ultimate long-run consequences to the political system as a whole. That is the general thesis of my paper, and you can look into it if you care to more carefully by looking at the paper itself. Now, I'm going to suggest just here, by way of appendix to my paper, that, after all, cheerfulness will keep breaking in, and that this is not an entirely irresistible tendency to centralization. For instance, we have seen in recent weeks in America a successful resistance to the centralizing power tendency I have suggested. I think, for instance, particularly of the defeat in the Rules Committee of the House of Representatives of the United States of America, the defeat of that body of the proposal for massive federal funds for support of the schools, House Bill 7,300, which proposed to give about $2,300,000,000 almost at once for subsidizing local school districts, so-called public schools. This bill, after great pressure was applied for its passage, was at length bottled up in the Rules Committee and will not come out this session, if indeed ever. Now, the reasons for this, this bill are interesting. Behind the bill was very great political pressure from the National Education Association and its affiliated state bodies. In Washington, the National Education Association is the most important lobby, most powerful lobby, more powerful even than the lobby of the labor unions. In each of the several states, the State Education Association is ordinarily more powerful than any other lobby there. These bodies obtain large funds from the membership by more or less compulsory deduction, and proceeded to use this money to bring pressure upon the members of Congress to pass this massive aid for the schools. They had a well-organized, well-financed campaign. They've been at it now for approximately 10 years, trying to get a federal bill nominally in aid of education. And it appeared that this year, at last, they would succeed. They were, in fact, so confident that they were already dividing the spoils. And I have seen letters from various school superintendents and persons in authority in the National Education Association saying how much money is going to be used for this purpose, how much for that, and drawing up their budgets accordingly on both the state and the local scale. Yet the bill was defeated. Well, why? Now, if you read the newspapers, you'll find favorites, as usual, give very simple reasons, which often are rather superficial. According to the newspapers, these bills were defeated, particularly the House Bill 7,300, because the Catholics were against it and the Protestants were against it. The Catholics were against it because they thought they wouldn't get certainly constituents, let alone act intelligently upon these concerns. Therefore, they entertained a very strong and justifiable and just prejudice against the bill in the beginning. And when, by the volume of mail against it from various quarters, they were given a list of pretexts of saying, well, the will of the people used to be opposed to this bill, they therefore voted against it. And in fact, it was for expedience, not, of course, to have to vote against it, either for or against it, but to let it die in committee. That is exactly the function for which the House Rules Committee has always been designed, to prevent the coming to the floor of certain demagogic measures which would embarrass Congress to vote upon in public, and the House Committee therefore put an end to this bill, as it has put an end to bills of a demagogic nature for more than 100 years. Now, I'm suggesting here, in short, that there is still in the United States a strong prejudice and a sound prejudice in favor of territorial democracy, a feeling that centralization is wrong and is dangerous, and if there's any way of getting around it, we won't have centralization. That was certainly at work in the minds of congressmen. It was at work in the minds of almost all governors in several states who are almost unanimously opposed to federal control and financing of education. It certainly appears to have been true among the majority of citizens who felt severe qualms about the possibility of federal control of education, and it was true, so far as I can determine, among the majority of teachers, who might indeed be brainwashed into saying, well, yes, we need more money from the federal government. When they were asked, well, would you like federal control? The answer from the great majority of teachers I talked with was always no. They, too, had a prejudice still, even though they couldn't use the phrase, against centralization, against the mass society, and in favor of global control of local affairs, or territorial democracy. So, in short, the Chartists does keep breaking in, and it is possible still to gain victories in this struggle for prescriptive and local government against the mass society. At the same time, if this resistance and this restoration of genuine order and freedom is to become practicable, it is necessary also to undertake certain prudent reforms in territorial democracy as in other things. A great deal of reform is advisable in local government in America. I think, for instance, of the function of the Justice of the Peace, because I happen to be one. My first and only political office. Now, the Justice of the Peace in my state of Michigan or elsewhere in the United States is an important functionary, but one whose duties are now confused and in part arcane. There are probably too many justices of the peace. There are not enough of those elected who are competent to fulfill their duties or have any will to fulfill them. But their power probably ought not to be diminished, but instead ought to be increased. There ought to be a reform of the office, but actually an increase of their global powers. And so far as possible, the use of a bench of justices of the peace rather than juries in a great many civil and criminal cases. Well, such a reform is highly advisable, yet such are the pressures for centralization that even those justices of the peace who see the need for reform are hesitant to allow any kind of reform because they feel that in the process of reform, the entire office might be abolished and the centralization of, in this case, of the bench of legal decision carried on with great haste to a bench, to a body of state judges, and any kind of local control of local affairs in the legal sense. Any kind of control over ordinary, small, civil claims, or in the case of traffic offenses or poaching, all this might be entirely abolished by reform because of the present enthusiasm for centralization, either in the state capitals or in Washington. Therefore, the very pressure for centralization tends itself to make